You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. The second half of life comes with a tremendous amount of change. But can you get in front of some of those changes and take a proactive approach? Our guest today, Michael Clinton, is the author of the new book, Roar Into the Second Half of Your Life Before It's Too Late. Michael Clinton is the former president and publishing director of Hearst Magazines and is currently special media advisor to the Hearst Corporation's CEO. He is also an author and photographer who believes that everyone should strive to live their fullest life possible to optimize the second half of life. An avid traveler, Michael has experienced 124 countries and has run marathons on 7 continents. He is a private pilot and a part owner of a vineyard in Argentina, has started a nonprofit foundation, holds 2 master's degrees, and still has a long list of life goals and experiences he plans to tackle. He resides in New York and Santa Fe. So, Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's so great to be here with you, Joe. I'm excited to have this conversation.
Really enjoyed your book, and our listeners have heard your bio. But before we talk about your book, Roar, I wonder if you could tell us more about your story, starting with coming to New York City with $60.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I came from a working class family, a first one to go to college. And I had this dream. I was the publisher of my university newspaper, and I had this dream to be in the publishing business. And so I came to New York with, as you said, $60 in my pocket and a couch to sleep on for a couple of months, no contacts, and said, okay, let's begin. And, you know, like any young, ambitious person, I found my way. It took a little while, but I found my way and got my first job actually as a journalist for a business publication at Fairchild and Fairchild Publications. And then I moved into the publishing side and I was launched. So I'm a little bit of an anomaly because I spent 42 years in the magazine publishing industry and closed out that chapter as president and publishing director of Hearst Magazine. So, as I like to say, I had a good run and it was a great experience to start from the bottom and work my way through. So, yeah.
So, you wrote in the book about your mother and your grandmother. What did you learn from them about the second half of life?
The interviews that I did in the book with 40 individuals, I call them the reimagineers. These are people who in midlife made big changes in their life, work, personal, professional. My mother, who is a great inspiration, was, I call her a serial reimagineer. She was, in her early life, she was a nun. She left the convent. She ultimately, obviously, married my father. They had 6 children. She was a homemaker. When most of the kids were grown up, she made a decision to become a travel agent, starting from nowhere, and ended up traveling lots of places around the world. And then when she was 64, she asked my father for a divorce. No other people involved. She just wanted to live a different kind of life than he did. And she did that for another 23 years before she passed on. So she had courage and she had vision and she had a true sense of where she wanted to be and go during the course of her life. So she was a great role model. My grandmother, who didn't have much education at all, was just one who always believed in vision and visioning your future and focusing on it. She and my grandfather had a small business, and she too was an inspiration just in terms of instilling that in me and others, the possibilities of what can be in all periods of your life, you know, as well as the second half. So 2 great women who were great influences along with my father and a couple of other teachers that I had along the way.
So the title of your book is Roar Into the Second Half of Your Life Before It's Too Late. But what does the acronym ROAR stand for?
Yeah, thanks. You know, first of all, the awareness was that if you're 50 and you're healthy today, you have a really good shot at living to be 90 and or 100. And the construct that we were handed by our parents and by both government policy and corporations is a very outdated construct. In the days they were developed, in the days when things were, the life expectancy, quite honestly, was in the early 60s. And so you'd check out of a job and you wouldn't live much longer. Well, all that's changed, as you know. So ROAR, and the acronym that it stands for, is designed to help people have that aha moment about this. So the R is reimagine yourself and be one of those reimagineers before others do it for you, whether it is being laid off or pushed out or any of the above. And reimagining your favorite future, especially if you're going to have this long life arc. The O is own who you are. You know, at midlife, I like to call it a midlife awakening, not a midlife crisis, because once you've lived 25 years, you know a lot about yourself. So use that awakening that you've made good decisions, bad decisions, just kind of own them and sort of assess where you are right now. But at the same time, own your numbers. I mean, think about, it's amazing to me, Joe, how many people I ask, what's your blood pressure or your heart rate? And they're completely clueless. And, you know, that's not a good thing, because as we live longer, we need to keep our health numbers and metrics in place, our financial numbers. We need to own our successes and our failures. So own who you are is a big part of this book. A is act on what's next for you and be courageous. You know, I just cited my mother's experience, but act now with this concept called life layering, which I hope we can get into and talk about. And then the final R is reassess your relationships, because when you're in midlife and you want to make a change in whatever part of your life you're talking about, you need the support of your family, your friends, your community, your colleagues. They're the ones who are going to help facilitate that. And so you got to really have a clear head as to who they are and who your posse will be to get you there. So it's kind of this four-step process, which is in the book, which stands for ROAR.
So when you think about it, what misconceptions do you think people have about the second half of life based on your 40 interviews and other conversations you've had?
Well, I think the one thing that I would say is that we are sort of wired to think about what a 50-plus life is supposed to be, which is an outdated concept. So the biggest mistake people make is they create self-imposed ageism. And so I like to say it's not age appropriate, it's person appropriate, because you can parent at 50, you can start a new business at 65 or 70, you can get remarried at 80. I mean, there's a lot that you can do in terms of creating your person appropriate approach to second half. You know, we live in a culture of ageism to begin with, both words and images, but so it's a constant fight that the individual has to have. But I find that most people put barriers around themselves. And these 40 individuals who told their amazing stories, they were able to free themselves of that barrier and go back to school at a later age, start new careers, start new relationships. And they don't buy into what they were told they're supposed to do. And they're making their lives bigger, not smaller, which a lot of people do as they move into their 60s, 70s, and 80s.
You mentioned life layering, and that's one of the big ideas among many that I'm taking away from ROAR. How have you personally layered your life over time?
You know, I think one of the things that I realized at a young age, two things. One is that we all sit in a professional seat, and it's really a bad idea to have your self-identity tied up into that seat, because someday that seat's going to go away. So you're going to have to think about how you are going to redefine who you want to be. So life layering was a concept I started when I was around 39 years old and thought all I was doing was working and invested in my professional seat. I was the publisher of GQ, great job. But I started to build this new idea of life layering. And my 40s were what I call my adventure years, because that's when I started doing a lot of great adventure travel and I became a pilot and I went hiking in mountains around the world. And I kept that layer going and I continue to keep that layer going. And my 50s were my, what I call my creative years, with a lot of photography and writing and books that I published in my photography. And that layer keeps going. So when I stepped out of the day to day, you know, I had multiple layers going on as to how I defined myself. So it was adventure and it was creativity and it was philanthropy and it's entrepreneurialism. And so when I stepped out, I had this whole other sense of who I was. And the issue that a lot of people have is they wait until they get there and they say, well, I'll figure it out when I get there. And then they struggle and have a hard time. So it is this notion of layering, creating layers as you go along in your life so that you have a richness as you get to your second half and then keep going.
That's interesting because I hear that so much from people in terms of the non-financial side of retirement. How hard can it be? I'll just wing it. But what you're saying is there's such an advantage to starting early, doing it along the way so you're ready.
Yeah, absolutely. Doing it along the way. A lot of the folks that I interviewed in this book, they didn't do the what I'm espousing, the life layering concept over a lifetime. What they did is they spent a good 1 to 2 years figuring out what they wanted to do next, both from a developmental standpoint and then from the concrete steps, the actual practical things that they needed to do to set themselves up as they sort of pivoted out of a first career. And for many of them, it was starting a second career in a whole new area. Maybe it was through a passion or a hobby or through education, but they put in the time. They really put in the deep thinking to figure out how to do that, get themselves set up.
So looking at your backgrounds, reading your book, hearing you just talk today with a couple of the examples, there's many more in the book of the fascinating things that you've been involved in. People listening might think, man, it must take a lot of resources to be able to build a layered life. But I know from the stories in your book that they include people from all different types of backgrounds. How is a layered life, in your opinion, more accessible than people might think at first glance?
It's a great question. And I'll start with something around the concept of lifelong learning and education, because many people say as they're in mid 45, 50, whatever, I'd love to go back to school and learn something else and do something else. And you're a great example of that. But a lot of people say, I don't have the money to do it or the time. Well, first of all, we make the time for the things that are important. But there's an enormous amount of money out there for adults who want to pivot. And whether it's Pell Grants or federal grants or some states, when you reach a certain age, you can go to college for free in the state university system. So there's always a way. One of the great stories in the book was a 53-year-old woman who was a book editor who decided she wanted to become a doctor, which is, you know, a very complex and long process. And what she did is she found a path, and she found it through funding and financing her education through all of these different sources. And she got her entire education funded for it. So I think education, there's no excuse if you want to learn something new. It's accessible to anyone. And plus, there's a lot on MOOCs, if you're familiar with MOOCs, mass open online courses where you can learn new things and get certificates and retrain yourself to do something. It's just a question of being imaginative and innovative and creative.
My wife says, I'm a lifelong learner in my case because I have so much more to learn.
There you go. Great line.
That's a great thing. So people go through different phases and stages, and sometimes you encounter an enemy called inertia. Mm-hmm. So it's a big enemy to the type of life that you're outlining. When people feel stuck and almost like they're on autopilot going through the motions, what should they do to pivot?
I was just having this discussion the other night because I think that as people get into, let's say, their early 60s and they start thinking about leaving their first career and they start planning, what they begin to realize is for the first year or so, you might like the freedom and you might like I can do my own schedule and I can go do my sport activity, whatever it is. And hopefully there's a fitness activity in their life. I can go visit my family and my friends, COVID aside. But I think they also have this like realization that, wow, I may live another 30 years. So this sort of post first career year or two is not going to sustain me for 30 years. And I think that becomes a huge motivator for people to start thinking about how am I going to have value in my life and how am I going to be able to deliver value in my life? And I always like to say, go to 90 and work backwards and write what it is that you have contributed to the world, to the community, to your family. What's your legacy? Like, what do you want to do? And I think those kinds of mental exercises get people out of inertia and start thinking that I better find another meaningful path. Because I think most people at this stage of life, they do want purpose and they do want meaning and they do want to be continued to be engaged and be relevant. And so that those thoughts alone can get you out of the inertia.
And I love the question you mentioned earlier that's in the book. What's your favorite future?
Yeah, that people always get stumped by that and they start, well, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, you know, go out a few years. You know, what is it that you're hoping to accomplish? What do you want to do? And I think that that happens, that question, you can ask that question at any time in life. I remember asking my mother that question when she was about 83 or 84. And my mother's response was to have a happy death. And I was like, okay, Mom, I think when you're that age, you start thinking about end of life. And she died in her sleep peacefully. So we were blessed that she didn't go through a lot of pain and agony. But I think you ask that question to people all the time. I ask 20-year-olds that question. I ask 50-year-olds that question. It makes people think because we have to be in a constant state of rewiring and rethinking our lives. It's a lifelong process. So yeah, it's really a good question to ask people.
And it's great to bring it back because if you ask a 6-year-old that question, you get a lot of answers with a lot of enthusiasm. Somehow we lose that ability to think about that.
Yeah, no, we definitely lose that. I always say to people, go back to your earlier, younger self and ask yourself, you know, what did you leave behind that was of interest to you?
So in your case, Michael, you completed a master's at Columbia at 67 in nonprofit management. What was it like to go back to school in your 60s, and how were you involved in the not-for-profit sector today?
Well, I have to admit, going back to school in your 60s can be a little daunting. The first thing I had to learn, which was significant, was the technology and the learning platform, which was Canvas, and that had its whole new set of technology that I had to master, which I did. I was totally stimulated by the program. It was 12 courses. You know, needless to say, I was one of the older folks in the program. And I brought a lot of value to the younger professionals, and they brought a lot of value to me. It was interesting writing papers again and taking tests and having to participate in group discussions. But the reason I did it is I love the sector, and I'm on multiple nonprofit boards. I'm on Pace University's board, International Center of Photography, Advertising Council. I have my own foundation. I really like the sector and want to be engaged in the sector. So I wanted to teach myself a lot more about it, which was really a blessing. And yes, I became a proud graduate of the master's degree at the age of 67. And it just also reminded me that lifelong learning is such an important part of how we continue to expand our minds, because the mind, as you know, is a great muscle. So yeah, it was great. It was great fun.
So new topic, marathons. 7 marathons on 7 continents. Wow. So which one was the most challenging, and how does adventure help in the second half of life?
So I'm one of less than 1,000 people in the world who've done that feat, which I learned, which is kind of cool. It really started, I was a marathon runner in my younger years. And in my mid-50s, my sister called me and said, would you like to run a marathon with me? And I said, well, when did you start running? She said, tomorrow. So I was like, okay, I got one more in me. So we decided to go and run the London Marathon because it was her birthday week. And so a bunch of family went over and we ran the race. And the night before, we had gone to a party that was hosted by Runner's World magazine, which we publish. And I met a guy who'd run 7 marathons on 7 continents. And I was like, gee, that is really a fun idea. So we didn't think much of it. But then after it was her first marathon, and she said, I'm ready to do another one. So I said, well, let's do another one somewhere else in the world. So we went to Buenos Aires and we ran that one. And then we just kept going. We ran one a year. And I think the one that when we were going to Asia, rather than pick a street race like Tokyo or Singapore, I said, let's do something really out of the box. And we picked a race in Mongolia, which was way up in the north in the mountains. And it ended up being a mountain marathon, which is something I'd never done before. Very challenging, out in the middle of nowhere in the wilderness, following green markings on stones and trees, obviously no spectators, an occasional yak. We lived in yurts. And it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. And what it taught me, aside from the challenge of it, is that we have to continue to challenge our own boundaries and push ourselves in ways that we didn't think we could. And so that was a really great learning lesson about the marathoning and the challenging. Running Antarctica was a challenge unto itself, an amazing experience. But the one in Mongolia was really amazing. So I still run a marathon a year. You know, in the book, I read about a guy who was the first 100-year-old to cross the finish line in a marathon. Falja Singh, and I had the opportunity to meet him. And I'm like, that's, you know, I don't know if I'd be running marathons at 100, but I'm sure going to try.
That's great. What's up next?
Well, this year is kind of a wash because of the pandemic, but I'll do another one next year. I kind of like the smaller ones. And in the marathoning world, a smaller one means 15,000 people. So I liked, you know, I ran Dublin, I ran Toronto. Mm-hmm. You know, I like the smaller, the big 60,000 people marathons can be a little daunting. One of them, it'll be one of those at that size.
I wonder if I ask you, if you think about all the stories that you have in your book, and there's a lot of great ones, is there one story that you'd like to share with people to give them a sense of Roar and a sense of the book?
Yeah, it's 40 beautiful stories. I mean, I think one of the stories that always inspired me is a guy named Jim Gath, who when he was 50, he lost his business, his wife left him, and he realized that he had a drinking problem and he had to go to deal with that. And he said he was sitting under a tree and he said, well, the future's mine to do and whatever I want to do. And he got involved with horses and he ended up getting with some family members, have a horse sanctuary in Arizona. And they take abused and neglected horses in, and then they use those horses for autistic adults and children in terms of horse therapy. And he's done this now for a decade, and he's in his late 60s. And he said, you know, I spent my first half of my life chasing materialism and all the things we're supposed to do, or we were told we're supposed to do. And this work I'm doing now is the most rewarding work. It's my life calling. And, you know, it took some real crises in his life to get to that place because he was kind of humming along. And so that's what I mean about reimagining before something or someone does it to you, be proactive. And Jim's story is a great story. He just, you know, continues to thrive in the great work he's doing.
And Michael, last question. What's the main message of Roar that you want people to take away from your book?
You know, the main message is be true to yourself and go back to what did I abandon that is mine, or what did I compromise that was mine that I shouldn't have compromised. And some great stories in the book on this too. A guy whose father said to him, I'll only pay for your college education if you study business. And he really wanted to be a social worker and be in the social justice space. And at 50, he had a meltdown because he said, what am I doing? You know, I had this 20, he's had a 25-year, you know, business career, successful, but he just couldn't go on with it any further. So he left his job, he took some time off, did some traveling, and he had an epiphany when he did this ayahuasca ceremony in Peru, which you might be familiar with. And he saw himself as a 17-year-old and he said, I'm so sorry that I abandoned you. And he came back and he's now in the social work, social justice space. I tell a story in the book, Rob Smith, and you know, couldn't be happier. So I think being true to yourself and being true to your what you really want to do with your life and how you really want to experience your life and the things that really matter to you, you got to course correct if you abandon them. And following your own North Star is what will bring you fulfillment and satisfaction and enrichment in your life in a lifelong way. So that's my message, true to yourself.
Great message. And Michael, thanks so much for taking the time to share your insights with us.
Joe, it's great to be with you. And thanks so much for your interest in Roar.
Thanks.
Available now on all platforms.
Thanks to Michael Clinton for talking with us today about his new book, Roar. It's a very inspiring book, and it helps you to think about new ways to reimagine your future. Here are three things that jumped out to me during the conversation. There are many more in the book that'll get your attention. First thing is his stance on reject ageism. Have you ever had anyone say to you, I don't think that's really age appropriate? I love what he said. Think, what's person appropriate, not age appropriate? Number two is his concept of life layering. What he didn't tell you today, but is in the book, is that came up because he decided at one point, I think he was 39 or so, that he was the most boring person he knew. He decided to change that. And boy, he certainly sounds like he has. And what he decided to do was to create a new layer that he could add. What could he add to his life that would be interesting and meaningful and fun? And so a question for you is, what's that one thing you could add? What's that new layer you could add to your life this year and perhaps next reminds me of what Andy Robin recently talked with us about, tapas life. What's that one thing you can add on? What's that small plate, small meal you can add into the mix to start? Doesn't have to be a big thing. What's that next project for you? Number three is his question. That's the one that I'll conclude on. What's your favorite future worth it? So if you're listening to this podcast, you've probably done some work on preparing financially for your retirement. But let's face it, you haven't worked this hard to just have a mediocre retirement. So what if you prepare just as well on the non-financial side? It'll help you be ready to really create that life that you've dreamed about, that you really worked so hard to earn. And you'd be positioned to be able to avoid some of the pitfalls that derail too many retirements today. These pitfalls are no joke because they can waste your most valuable asset, your time. So instead, invest some time in thinking about how you can design your new life. Think like an owner. Invest some time to explore your options and discover the path that's really the right one for you on your own terms. It's your time now and time to get ahead of the game. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com. You'll find all of our podcast episodes you can browse there, as well as free tools. And if you'd like to schedule a call to discuss our Design Your Life coaching programs, you can do so right on the site. Thank you so much for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. We'll be back next week with a new episode.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.